Okay, so we're going to start with chapter 27, verse 1. Oh, verse 11. 27, 11. Okay, Chris, why don't you do that first one?
Now Jesus stood before the governor, and the governor asked him, "Are you the king of the Jews?" Jesus said to him, "You have said so." But when he was accused by the chief priests and elders, he made no answer. Then Pilate said to him, "Do you not hear how many things they testify against you?" But he gave him no answer, not even to a single charge, so that the governor wondered greatly.
Okay, Jesus' silence throughout all of this, actually, if you look at the handout that, this handout here, even procedurally, when a person who is being questioned makes no answer, that does not implicate them as guilty, okay? And the fact that Matthew mentions here in verse 14, he gave him no answer. So that the governor wondered greatly. As we continue along in these passages, you'll begin to get the sense that it's almost as if, and again, if you added this to the way Luke treats it, Mark treats it, and John treats it, it's almost as if you're getting the idea that even though Jesus is on trial, Pilate's on trial. Like, he's the one who actually is unsure about, what is truth? Okay? Or are you really the king of the Jews? And he can clearly see from a very secular, humanistic point of view, this man is no king, at least not in the worldly sense, right? And then, of course, Claudia, his wife, Pilate's wife, is saying, "I had a dream about this man, have nothing to do with him. He is holy." Okay? And so this entire episode is going to start to reveal very much a torn Pontius Pilate. Publicly, he wants to succumb to the crowd because he doesn't want to get himself in trouble. Privately, he knows Jesus is an innocent man. It's like, privately, I'm pro-life, but publicly, I don't want to lose my seat. So, you see what I'm saying? There's this lack of consistency between one's private opinion and how one publicly conducts themselves, okay? And we see this dichotomy time and time again. I mean, there's just this sense of, almost duplicitousness. Okay, now, let me just say a couple of other things here too. Evan has a coughing today here. Okay, maybe she needs a cough drop, Joan. You need to go in there. Okay. All right. I'm sorry. The reason I'm not looking at the right things, I'm not looking at the right page. I just want to make sure that I didn't miss anything from this commentary to add to what I just said. Okay. Now, Matthew does not tell us what the charge was, but Luke does. In the Sanhedrin, the charge was leveled against Jesus. Against Jesus was blasphemy. Okay? But if you look further in Luke's version here, they say, this is so sinister, "What has this man done?" And then they say, "We would not have brought him to you had he not done something gravely wrong." And Pilate's like, whoa. Because, see, the only reason Pilate would have to see someone is because they wanted the death penalty. Because they had enough authority to flog Jesus, to rough him up, and then just to let him go. They would say to chastise him, but then to let him go. Okay? But the only reason that they were going to Pilate was because they wanted someone to leverage someone to put him to death. Okay? So in Luke, we actually find that there are three things. Okay? First, Jesus is a revolutionary. Second, he incites the people not to pay their taxes. And then third, claims to be a king. This is all in Luke 23. If you want to look that up later. So one, Jesus is a revolutionary, not true. In fact, he says, "Render unto Caesar what is Caesar's, and to God what is God's." So, and by the same charge, inciting people not to pay their taxes. Not true. Okay? And then the third is that he claims to be a king. Well, that is true, but he never says a worldly king. Okay, so these are all three fabricated political charges made to Pilate, which he would care about. Pilate could care less about blasphemy as a charge. Now, what is it to Pilate? I mean, he's not even a Jew. Okay, I mean, he may not even recognize what blasphemy really is as far as the Jews understand it. So they had to come up with other charges, and they're all false. Okay? All right. So the other part of Pilate's role, which is also very interesting, is Pilate was not answerable to the Senate in Rome, but directly to the emperor. Okay? Which means that Pilate's situation could be adjudicated much quicker because you didn't have to go through the deliberation of voting in the Senate about what could happen to him. See, when you start multiplying the number of people who can decide your fate, it slows down the process because, you know, people come in defense of you, there's back and forth, it kind of drags out, there's time for public opinion to creep in. But if it's just the emperor and he's considered God, then whatever the emperor says is done. So let it be written, let it be done. So for example, just to give you an idea of sort of how things are so interesting in Rome, you see this inscription all the time when you walk around Rome, all over the public works. Okay? Senatus popolorumque Romani, the Senate and the people of Rome. We as seminarians said it also stood for sona porci questi Romani. These Romans are pigs. Okay? But anyway, that's neither here nor there. Okay? But in Pilate's case, he could be answerable directly to the emperor. Now, what happened was, eventually, Pilate did meet a pretty bad end. In fact, he kind of vanishes from the annals of history. He either was killed, executed, or he committed suicide. So what happens is that a few years after Jesus' death, Pilate exacts a very harsh punishment on protesters of a particular decision he had made by sending his own men into the crowd dressed as Israelites, as Jews. And they were all carrying little daggers. And then they all took off their cloaks and they slaughtered all the people. So the governor of Syria heard, 3,000 people were killed. And the governor of Syria heard about the brutality, okay, and reported Pilate immediately to Rome. Pilate was arrested and sailed out of Caesarea Maritima, a place some of you have been to, okay, sailing west towards Rome, okay, and ends up either getting shipwrecked, committing suicide, or is executed. They're not sure what happened to him. But he suddenly vanishes from... And that was really the straw that broke the camel's back. Well, if that was the straw that broke the camel's back, this mob that's going to be incited here in a few verses is the penultimate move, the second to the last move. Okay, this is going to be almost at the tipping point of Pilate's career, and he knows it. Okay, because he had run into problems with the Jews time and time again, and the fact that he had brutally handled them before caused concern with Rome, because believe it or not, even though the Romans were brutal, they also had a deep sense of justice in the sense of not attacking innocent civilians, even if they were protesting or rioting. You had ways to try to keep them down without actually slaughtering them. It wasn't because they were particularly merciful people, but because they knew politically it was more expedient to treat them with a little bit more leniency so as to prevent future problems down the road. I mean, I suspect this is some of the take that the way our military handles Afghans and Pakistanis and Iraqis in certain situations in the Middle East is that, you know, it's not a good idea to just mow them all down. I mean, Geneva Convention aside and the laws of engagement aside, I mean, even if we could do that, it's probably better to try to win them over on a more local level. Long term, it works better. It prevents resentments from building up. And this is part of the reason why the Romans were able to govern the Mediterranean world for so long. Is they had a particular style about them that even their subjects knew that there was justice even for people like Pontius Pilate. Okay? And they had this very, very deep sense of justice about them, which I think is very, very fascinating if you're reading sort of like political theory. Okay. So, let's go on now to the next. Joan, do you have that there? I just love how you read. And it's verse 15 through 23. If you would.
Mm-hmm.
While he was sitting on the judgment seat, his wife sent word to him, "Having nothing to do with that righteous man, for I have suffered much over him today in a dream." Now the chief priests and the elders persuaded the people to ask for Barabbas and destroy Jesus. The governor again said to them, "Which of the two do you want me to release for you?" And they said, "Barabbas." Pilate said to them, "Then what shall I do with Jesus, who is called Christ?" They all said, "Let him be crucified."
Okay. Just as a side note before we talk about these verses, about Pilate, one of the legends in Rome is that Pilate was committed suicide when he got to Rome, and they flung his body into the Tiber, but his evil spirit so troubled the river that the Romans took the body out of the water and shipped it to Gaul in modern-day France on the east side of France and threw it into the Rhone River. And let's see here. Eventually, the body ends up in Lucerne. And they believe in Lucerne, they have the body of Pontius Pilate that they call the mountain where he's buried in Mount Pilatus. Interesting. Okay.
Lucerne but, is in Switzerland?
Yeah. Okay? All right. So, anyway, not a big pilgrimage site for Catholics. Okay. Okay, but still, you know, kind of interesting. I mean, you know. All right. So, okay, now, let's kind of review these verses here. Now, here, we know for a fact, Pilate knows a revolutionary when he sees one. Okay? This Jesus of Nazareth is no revolutionary. Pilate's used to dealing with revolutionaries. They pop up every 18 to 24 months in Israel, wanting to get the Romans out. And he knows the type. And Jesus, he says, this is Jesus, this king of the Jews charge, Pilate knows is completely bogus. Okay? Now, I don't know if I pointed this out to you at some other point, but you see the word Barabbas? Okay, that means son of the father. It's kind of ironic, isn't it? Do you want Jesus or the Son of the Father? Yeah, exactly. Now, there's another tradition that Barabbas' first name was also Jesus. Jesus is Latin for Yeshua, which is Joshua. The reason we call Jesus Jesus and Joshua is to distinguish the two. But Joshua's name in the Old Testament is, and if you look at the Passion, look what they call Jesus, Yeshua. That's Joshua. Okay, but to distinguish the two. So, you know, go back to John the Baptist last Sunday, baptizing in the Jordan River, right? He's preparing the way for the new Joshua to lead the people across into the Promised Land. Not from slavery in Egypt into the land of flowing with milk and honey, but from the slavery of sin into the promise of immortality. See? And the Jordan is the symbolic of the baptism, of baptism. Okay. So it's kind of interesting here that it's possible that Jesus, that Pilate might have been yelling out, "Do you want Jesus of Nazareth or Jesus Barabbas?" But they kept the name just, you know, Jesus and Barabbas to emphasize Jesus or the Son of the Father. Right?
And that's why they said, who called Christ, one called
Christ. No, Jesus called the anointed. Jesus called the Christ. So he has to make some distinguishing mark there so that they get the numbers right, the polling. You know, they release Jesus. Like, no, not him. Okay. Okay, So, again, so Pilate, in the next verse, saw that that he was gaining nothing, but that a riot was beginning. And he took water and washed his hands before the crowd. Okay, I'm innocent of this righteous man's blood. See to it yourselves. Okay? And all the people answered, his blood be on us and on our children. Mm. And then he released for them Barabbas, and having scourged Jesus, delivered him to be crucified. Okay, now, let's talk about that for a second. All right? Now, one thing to be said about the way that Jesus is handled here, okay, is that this is the lead up to Pilate's decision on how to handle the riot by using Jesus as the scapegoat. Pilate becomes governor of Judea in the year 26 AD, 7 years before Jesus of Nazareth comes before him, okay? But Pilate had run into some problems before. Let me just name a couple. The Roman headquarters were about 2.5 hours north on the coast of the Mediterranean in Caesarea Maritima. When the Romans used flags, they didn't use, as their standard, they didn't use flags, they used poles mounted with the Roman eagle. But the Jews protested that because that was considered making graven images. So as they're marching into Jerusalem with graven images, the Jews take this as a major religious affront because, you know, the temples where Yahweh dwells. And here comes Pontius Pilate with idols. And that caused a riot. Okay? Then Pilate also built an aqueduct to give Jerusalem a better water supply, which was a wise decision. Bad part, he took money from the temple treasury to pay for it. Okay? So Pilate has run into these problems before, and he sees a riot fomenting. Okay, now, if you watch The Passion of the Christ, and it's we're blessed to have that sort of as a reference point, you notice how this is all developing sort of in the film, right? And Pilate is like, Claudia, if I don't put this guy to death, we are done here. And Judea was considered to be like a backwater assignment, the least prestigious assignment in the entire Roman Empire, because the Jews were so difficult to deal with. Okay, nothing's changed. Okay. So, anyway, all right. So, these things are sort of developing and sort of fomenting. Now, the one thing here that we don't have, okay, is that we don't have the way that it's set up in the other Gospels, if you take the other three together, okay, is that, and the Passion depicts this, Pilate has him flogged, and then they bring him out, and they say, Ecce homo, behold the man. Remember when they bring Pilate, Jesus out after he's been scourged, and Pilate's like, he told Abner, or whatever the guy, he said, I told you to flog him, not to kill him, right? And it's amazing, because the soldiers are still amazed that Jesus is still standing after what he's just gone through, okay? And, you know, and the mystical writers of the church said that it was not motivated by physical prowess, but just merely love for the human race. Okay, it was only love that motivated Christ to still stand up, okay? So the sequence is Jesus is flogged, crowned with thorns, then brought out. And the depiction, based on the other three Gospels, is that Pilate's hoping that the crowd will have mercy on Jesus and say, okay, enough. And that will be enough to satiate their bloodlust. And then that's when the back and forth becomes between Barabbas and Jesus. Remember now, then they bring Barabbas out and he's like a lunatic, right? You know, and he can't even believe they're going to let him go. Okay. And again, that whole thing was that, you know, you have a custom in your law to release one prisoner during the Sabbath. Okay. Because remember, the Sabbath is the mini Jubilee. And one of the things that you do with the Jubilee is you let prisoners go. So they would let one criminal out. Okay. So, all of these things that are happening, are completely consistent with the entire Jewish life. You know, I mean, I'm amazed sometimes when people read these things and they say, well, this is just all a fable and a myth. And I'm like, well, okay, but it's pretty well constructed because it's perfectly, I mean, it's like a really, it's like a really good historical fiction. Because, you know, a good historical fiction tries to put a fictional story in the backdrop of real events in the world, you know? Almost like, you know, like Gladiator is like a historical fiction. I mean, all those things were happening. I mean, I don't know whether or not it was, you know, Maximus versus that, you know. But the whole thing was that, you know, all the references to the history are correct. So it makes Gladiator a much more compelling movie because it's really based on somewhat true events in terms of just at least the overall ambience. So same thing with Pilate here. I mean, he's not doing anything at all that is at all out of turn or unusual about how the Jews would have handled such persons. Yet, interestingly enough, one of the things that the crowd cries out, he goes, "What shall I do with your king?" And the Jews cry out, "We have no king but Caesar." Ironically, that's blasphemy, the very charge Jesus was found guilty of in Caiaphas' house. You see that? "We have no king but Caesar." Oh, that's a major no-no for the Jews, because the only king they have is God. So, I mean, and then not only are they claiming to have an earthly king, but the very king that they've been trying to oust for decades is the one they claim as their own. I mean, even from a humanistic point of view, the Jews would have been better served being ruled by a human king like Jesus than Caesar. Because he's a Jew, he's God-fearing, you know, he's observant. I mean, he has all the marks of what would make a good king. Yet they're claiming Caesar as their king. You know? So really, Caesar knows when he hears "we have no king but Caesar," he knows that these people are just rabidly crazy. They just want him dead. There's no reasoning with this crowd. Okay? So succumbing to human weakness, watching his own political future, instead of really doing the right thing, okay? And it's almost like an interesting, almost like, I don't know, poetic justice that Pilate meets the end that he does, because his political machinations eventually caught up with him, and he eventually ends up dying a pretty tragic death, you know? It's interesting to imagine what Pilate would have done if he had just released Jesus. I mean, we don't know, because you know, the rest of the stories are salvation, but just interesting. Yeah.
I was just going to mention, it kind of reminds me of the episode in Samuel where the Jews asked for a king.
Yeah. Yeah. You
know, where God really doesn't have that in his plan.
Right.
They want to have a king, but they want a king because they see
all the other countries
around them having kings, and they want to be like everybody else.
Right. Well, another example would be in Exodus and Deuteronomy. Jesus is asked about this. You know, in Moses' law, a man could write a bill of divorce, and Jesus says, Moses permitted divorce because of the hardness of your hearts. He made a concession. Having Saul, then David, then Solomon, then all the other kings was a concession because of the stiff-neckedness of the Jews. It wasn't really his plan, nor was divorce. Jesus says, he lets you have divorce because of your hardness of heart. But in the beginning, it was not so. And that's why he goes back to his teaching on marriage. And that's why the church doesn't believe in divorce. Right? That's why we have the annulment process to prove that the bond never existed in the first place. Divorce says you were married and now you're not. Annulment is saying, no, you were never married. You said vows, but they didn't stick. Okay? All right. So, let's go on here. Now, the soldiers of the governor took Jesus into the praetorium, and they gathered the whole battalion before him. I actually, another number they use is cohort, and I actually did the math here, and I actually found that I have to look at this again. I can't believe I don't know where I put it, but I think it was, here we go. 600 men in a detachment. Unlikely there were that many in Jerusalem when Jesus was killed. So probably at least maybe a third to half of that. So we're looking about 150 men to 300 men, somewhere in there. Okay, now, could you imagine if you're a prisoner and you're in the barracks of 300 men and the penalty is death?
I mean, just you know, the mental anguish of knowing like that's where you are, you know. Oh my goodness. Okay. So they gathered the whole battalion before him. They stripped him and put a scarlet robe upon him, and plaiting a crown of thorns, they put it on his head and put a reed in his right hand. And kneeling before him, they mocked him, saying, "Hail, King of the Jews." They spat upon him and took the reed and struck him on the head. And when they had mocked him, they stripped him of the robe and put on his own clothes and led him away to crucify him. Now, just a little bit of sort of the torture part here, just to bring this to mind. The thorns in the Holy Land, the Jerusalem thorns, are about that long, and they're as firm as golf pencils. They're not flimsy. They're like pegs. So the Shroud of Turin, if that's authentic, shows that they didn't make Jesus a crown, they made him a cap. And when they say they're striking him on the head, they were trying to knock the pegs into the cranium, the thorns into the cranium. So it's not just like, you know, you're talking about thorns of a rose bush, which are, you know, little things that are, you know, I mean, are hit hard enough, they'll break. I mean, these are really like, it's basically putting on like barbed wire on his head, essentially, with extra long spikes. So that's what they're doing to him. Now, every time that they pull clothes on and pull clothes off after the scourging, it takes skin with it. So they're saying that by the time Jesus actually got the cross, he was already partially flayed because the skin had been ripped off with the clothing, plus the sweat, plus the blood, and the salt in the blood and the sweat sticking to the fabric. Okay, and so and it wasn't like, they weren't gentle, you know, like, okay, Jesus, sit here, just let me just gently peel this off you. I mean, you know, it's just this is torture. Okay, so there's no mercy here. Okay, then the crucifixion of Jesus. As they were marching out, they came upon a man of Cyrene, Simon by name. This man they compelled to carry his cross. Okay, now let me just stop there. All the Roman soldier had to do to impress an able man into service was basically two taps of his sword or his spear. And you had to jump into service. You had no choice. You were immediately put into service. Not slavery, not indentured service, but just for a particular task. And the soldiers could determine for how long you had to do it for. So if you look at the stations of the cross, this happens in the fifth station. Okay? So it's quite possible that Simon of Cyrene carried the cross of Jesus from the fifth station forward. They say, you know, like some of the depictions is Jesus has the top and Simon of Cyrene has the back. But it's also, in the Passion, it's different. Simon's got Jesus on one arm, and he's got the cross on the other arm. You notice that? And he's dragging him up that way. Some say that seems to be more likely the case. Interestingly, does anyone know where Cyrene is today? I know Joan and Chris know. Libya. Right. So that's where Simon of Cyrene is from. He's a Jew coming from Libya for the Passover. Little did he know who you'd meet. Later in the Acts of the Apostles, we learn his two sons, Alexander and Rufus, become leaders in the early church. So this moment of Simon of Cyrene is not just, I'm helping this. This is a conversion moment for Simon of Cyrene. I mean, he's becoming a believer. So much so that his sons were also baptized and became leaders in the early church. Likely they were both bishops. Okay. So it's interesting, right? I mean, did Simon of Cyrene know that day when he woke up that his name would be forever in history, right? And which is also very, very instructive for us. You know, you don't know what every day is going to bring. You know, you don't know what today's events are going to mean. You know, like I often think of 9/11. You know, I mean, let's say none of us per se were involved in it directly, right? But you know, when we went to sleep on 9/11 that night, did any of us believe that when we woke up in the morning of 9/11 that our country would have been dramatically changed in just a few hours and forever? I mean, you know, we're not going back to pre-9/11 security at airports anytime soon, okay? You know, and our sense of who our enemies are in a way completely really changed in the national consciousness. Okay, so this is Simon of Cyrene. Now, they come to the place called Golgotha, which means place of the skull. Now, there's a legend. It's not verifiable, but Golgotha, the place of the skull, is believed by some of the Jews to be where Adam is buried. Anyone ever heard that before? No. But you go to the Holy Land and you go to the Holy Church of the Holy Sepulchre. They call the chapel, Calvary's upstairs, and there's another chapel below it and downstairs. And below it, they call it the Adam Chapel because of the ancient Jewish belief that Adam is buried inside the rock there. Okay? Now, I don't know if that's true or not. I mean, if it is, it's kind of interesting because we've always called Jesus the new Adam, Mary the new Eve. Okay, so there are definite parallels there. The first man and the first, if you will, new man, you know, the new Eve. Okay, all those different things. Okay, so Golgotha, which means place of the skull. So they offer him this mixture of wine to drink mingled with gall, which is a, it's sort of like a vinegar-ish sedative to numb pain. Okay? But when he tasted it, he would not drink it. Okay, and remember the fourth cup? Mm-hmm. Wasn't ready yet. He's not going to drink it there either. So close. Okay, so he's not going to drink the fourth cup there either. Okay? And then they crucify him. They divided his garments among them by casting lots. Okay, this guy had something interesting to say about that. I think every Jew had four garments, and the fifth garment was what they were actually playing dice for. Okay? Here we go. These are the five articles of clothing. His shoes, his turban, his girdle, his inner garment, and his outer cloak. There were thus five articles of clothing and four soldiers. And I think they called them from that, call that number from the other Gospels. The first four articles were of equal value, but the outer cloak was more valuable, and it's what they were drawing lots for. Oh, in John 19, that's where you find it out. When the soldiers had divided the clothes, they sat down on guard until the end should come. So there was on top of Golgotha a group of three crosses, in the middle the Son of God, and on either side a brigand. Truly he was with sinners in his death, as he was in his life. Okay? So then they put the charge over him. This is the King of the Jews. Then you know the two robbers. Does anyone know the name of the robber, the name they traditionally ascribed to the good thief? Saint Dismas. They have the crossbeam of Saint Dismas's cross in Rome. That's about the length of this table. Okay? And then those who passed by derided him, wagging their heads, saying, "You who would destroy the temple and build it in 3 days, save yourself." Now, this is very, very ironic. Because Jesus did not say he'd destroy the temple. He was, remember, he was referring to the temple of his body. And they're yelling at him, "You who would destroy the temple, raise it up in 3 days." I mean, it would be me, of course, not our Lord. But, you know, our Lord would be like, "Don't worry. Just wait. I'll be back." Okay. But anyway. So then the chief priests and the scribes and elders mocked them. He saved others. He cannot save himself. He is the King of Israel. Let him come down now from the cross and we will believe in him. Now, you know, one of the temptations here, of course, is a temptation to pride. Right? The sense of wanting to be vindicated and saving one's reputation. You know, I always tell people, you know, this is a good mortification in penitential seasons like Advent and Lent, but the mortification on not having to have the last word, or not having the mortification of not having to explain yourself, you know, to justify yourself, you know, to look better in the eyes of others. St. Jose Maria used to say to the Lord, "If you don't need my good reputation, then neither do I." Okay. Okay. So, okay, now interestingly here, this account does not have the exchange between Dismas and Jesus. In this account, if you look on verse 44, the robbers who were crucified with him also reviled him in the same way. Okay, so you see there's some variances here. So if you notice, now, I take the movie The Passion of the Christ, right, because it's accounting for all of the gospel accounts. So, you know, it's like a synthesis. A movie like that is a synthesis of all of these different accounts. Because in this one, clearly, there is no Saint Dismas. I mean, well, he's there, but he ain't a saint. Because according to this, it would suggest that he's also reviling Jesus. Okay? All right. Now, from the sixth hour, there was darkness over the whole land until the ninth hour. Okay? So that's from noon till 3. And then about the ninth hour, Jesus cries out, Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani? My God, why have you forsaken me? Now that is from the Psalm. Let me see what Psalm that is. 22. Okay? And Psalm 22 runs through the entire Passion narrative. Listen to these phrases. He committed his cause to the Lord. Let him deliver him. Let him rescue him, for he delights in him. They divide my garments among them, and for my raiment they cast lots. Okay? So there are other instances of the use of Psalm 22. Okay? So, my God, why have you forsaken me? Now, you might wonder about that. The traditional understanding is that in his humanity, Jesus was experiencing the complete abandonment by the Father. In his humanity. Not in his divinity. That's impossible. But in his humanity, Jesus was experiencing complete abandonment by the Father. As part of the suffering he was taking on. So again, I know a lot of times we focus on the physical suffering, which is true and cannot be underestimated. But greater than the physical suffering, I said, I think last class, was the moral suffering of Jesus. Remember the sense that, you know, in spite of everything he was doing, there would be those who would not accept it. That's one aspect. The other side, too, is also feeling completely abandoned by the Father, which, by the way, is not unlike what Dante says in the Divine Comedy, are the words over the Inferno, abandon hope, all ye who enter here. That word abandonment comes in because it's a sense that the worst part about hell is there's no hope because you've been abandoned by God. See, in our lifetime, no matter how bad things may get, you always have hope that God will deliver me from this and I can still at least go to heaven. I have a friend who's in jail now for 30 years. He murdered his wife. His parents are obviously devastated, and they should be. I mean, I can't believe it. Okay? But I had to remind him the other day when they came to see me to talk and to pray about his situation. I said, well, listen, let's not despair. He can still go to heaven. I mean, in spite of his seemingly hopeless situation in this life, he actually has the hope of life eternal. And we have to do everything within our power to help him prepare for that day when it comes. And that he doesn't despair and take his life prematurely, which, as many of you know, happens in a lot of prisons. Suicide rate's fairly high. Okay? So, you know, but that's the worst part about hell. And Dante writes, abandon hope, all you who enter here. Ooh. Okay? All right. Okay, so they think that by yelling, Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani, in verse 47, some of the bystanders hearing it said, this man is calling Elijah. And so they want to assuage his pain. Now, this is a very interesting move. Okay, do they want to assuage his pain because they think that they can save his life? Probably not. But they do want to assuage his pain to see whether or not something fantastic might happen. Like Elijah might come. I mean, Jesus was, it's considered a powerful guy. I mean, he was a spiritual man. They felt like he had some powers to him. Maybe they were going to witness something even greater. Okay? And look, but others said, wait, let us see if Elijah will come to save him. Right? In other words, don't hasten his death. Give him some of the vinegar. Let's see if he calls out even more. Maybe by crying out loud enough, Elijah might come. Then we really have seen it all today. Of course, the irony is, if Elijah vindicates Jesus, he is the Messiah. Isn't that kind of funny how they're asking? I mean, they're almost tempting that Elijah might come back, but you idiots, if he does, he's got to be the Messiah, because Elijah would only come to vindicate the Messiah. Okay, so, yeah. a bunch of dummies. Okay. Okay, and then Jesus cried again with a loud voice and yielded up his spirit. Okay, now, this is a very important part. This is the fourth cup. It is finished. Consummatum est. The word in Hebrew, I'm sorry, in Greek, is tetelestai. T-E-T-E, tete, lestai, L-E-S-T-A-I. It's also the same in Aramaic. It is, in English, it is finished. In Latin, consummatum est, tetelestai. It is actually the cry of a victor, someone who has completed his task. It is the cry of a man who has won through the struggle. It is the cry of the man who has come out of the dark into the glory of the light. It is the man who has grasped the crown, often invoked as a battle cry by warriors after it had been decided on the field of battle who had won. Tetelestai. We had won the battle. Yeah, any of you guys ever see the movie Gladiator I mentioned? Do you remember what Maximus yells out after they win that battle in the opening scene? Remember that awesome opening scene? He grabs his sword and he says, Roma victor! Right? Rome has won. Okay? And that was like their version of tetelestai. The sense that we had won the day. Okay? So it's interesting that, you know, in this moment, Matthew depicts Jesus as the great warrior king who has conquered sin and death. Interesting, right? Not what we would think. His throne is the cross. What a paradox, right? A moment of death is a moment of life. Okay? Okay. Now, then the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom, and the earth shook and the rocks were split. The tombs also were opened, and many of the bodies of the saints who had fallen asleep were raised. And coming out of the tombs after his resurrection, they went into the holy city and appeared to many. Wow. What a day. Huh? I mean, I don't know how else you can understand that, but literally. I mean, it's not like, you know, like it's symbolic. I don't think so. I think this is, you know, take it as it is, okay? Now, when the centurion and those who were with him keeping watch over Jesus saw the earthquake and what had took place, they were filled with awe and said, truly, this was the Son of God. Okay, anyone remember his name, traditionally? John. Saint Longinus. John Wayne? No. Oh, my gosh. Saint Longinus. Okay. We still have in Rome, by the way, the spear tip of Saint Longinus.
There's four relics on each side of St. Peter's.
Yeah, I can't remember which one it was.
Was it the veil?
No. I don't remember. I always like the joke, because I can't remember what it is, but I always like the joke. They returned the baklava plate that the patriarch brought in his last visit to Rome. The baklava pyrex that he gave back. That made world news. Okay, the veil. Let's talk about the veil for a second. Okay, now this is interesting. The veil is the outer covering of the most inner chamber of the temple where they kept the Ten Commandments. It's called, that place is called the Holy of Holies, which is like the prototype of our sanctuary. That's why we had a rail around the sanctuary, not just for communion, but to separate, okay, the priest from the people. That's why in Byzantine liturgy, Orthodox liturgy, you go behind this screen. They call it it's in English you call it a rood screen, but they call it, what's it called?
Iconostasis,
right? It's like this icon shield. This, and the priest goes in, and you can't see a thing he's doing. You can only hear him. Okay, so the Holy of Holies could only be entered by the high priest one day a year, Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement. So this becomes the Christian Day of Atonement, Good Friday. Okay, now, at Yom Kippur for the Jews, they still do this. They get a goat, and they put the goat in the middle of the crowd, and everyone starts telling their sins to the goat, like they're putting their sins on the goat's head, and then they send the goat out to die in the Judean wilderness, i.e. scapegoat. That's where we get the term from.
Wow.
Did you know that? I know, you learn something new every day, right? Okay. Okay. So this is, if you will, Christ, the breaking of Christ's body is like the key that unlocks the distance between God and man, symbolized in the renting of the curtain, which could only be penetrated by the high priest, now the high priest, on the new Yom Kippur, the new Day of Atonement. The scapegoat is no longer the goat that's sent out to Judea. The scapegoat is the Son of God. He has become the scapegoat for our sins. So he has taken upon himself the role of the priest and the victim. All in one. Okay? Now, if you saw the Passion, again, very helpful. You remember this scene? Look, if you watch it again, I mean, maybe it's something worth watching again, maybe after Christmas, so you don't get depressed. But, you know, watch the moment of the crucifixion. You remember that nice cinematography where there's a tear that calls in the cloud? And remember the devil is like, ah, he's vanquished, right? But look behind the crucifixion scene of Mount Calvary and look at all the tombs on the hillside. They're all popping open like corkscrews on a champagne bottle. Boop, yeah. Boop, 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 boop. Okay, and that's what this is all about here, right? The tombs were also open, many of the bodies of the saints. And remember, tombs were sealed for stench and hygiene, okay? But also theologically, okay? Because you didn't want the spirit to leave, okay? So, you know, it's not just that, you know, the tomb, they just put a rock in front of the tomb and, you know, that there's like all these gaping holes. Because remember what Martha says to Jesus, Lord, he's been dead 4 days. By now there will be a stench. Not that there is a stench, because if he had been dead for 4 days and there was gaping holes around the rocks, you would have been able to smell him anyway, right? I mean, you guys know what a dead deer smells like by the side of the road, right? When you're driving by and, okay? So something like that. I mean, that is very pungent, okay? So apparently there's these people, these just people had fallen asleep. Now, what is happening here, remember, theologically, we're saying in the Creed, is that Jesus goes to limbo to preach the gospel to, that's why Paul calls him the firstborn of the dead. He descended into the dead. On the third day, he rose again. So when we say he descended into dead, it's after he died. He descended into the dead. Or we say he descended into hell, but not Satan hell, but Hades, the underworld. In the Greek, and he's releasing all of the souls of the just from limbo, because now the gates of heaven have been opened, which had been closed since Adam and Eve. So, I mean, I think it's always important for us to keep in mind, you know, the cosmic power of this moment of the death of Jesus. You know, and if you're watching The Passion of the Christ, you remember the part where the priests in the sanctuary seeing the earthquake that kind of destroyed the sanctuary and the temple was rent. I mean, it was a desecration of the temple. It really was. I mean, that was a desecration of the temple. I think it was very interesting, right? So just as they had desecrated Christ's body, so was their temple desecrated. Right? But, okay, eventually the temple would collapse in 70. Christ would rise 3 days later and lives forever. So the old has been superseded by the new. Okay? Okay. All right. And then there's this confession of faith in verse 54 by St. Longinus. Truly, this was the Son of God. There were also many women there looking on from afar who had followed Jesus from Galilee, ministering to him, among them whom were Mary Magdalene and Mary, the mother of James and Joseph, and the mother of the sons of Zebedee. Okay? So we've got, Mary seems to be a pretty popular name. Okay. Any questions about that so far? Okay, can I go on? Okay, we have to because we just do. Okay, this is it. This is like the final approach of the plane. This is it. Okay, so the burial of Jesus. Now, when it was evening, there was a rich man from Arimathea named Joseph, who was also who also was a disciple of Jesus. He went to Pilate and asked for the body of Jesus. Okay? And Pilate ordered it to be given to him, and Joseph took the body and wrapped it in a clean linen shroud and laid it in his own new tomb, which he had hewn in the rock, and he rolled a great stone into the door of the tomb and departed. Okay? And then Mary Magdalene and the other Mary were there sitting opposite the tomb. Now, remember, Joseph of Arimathea is a member of the Sanhedrin. Okay? Very unlikely that he was involved in that mockery of a trial the night before. Very unlikely. Okay? Interestingly, now he shows his true colors. Because this move sets Joseph of Arimathea as a marked man. Because remember, the Jews later want the tomb guarded because they don't want the disciples to come and steal the body. Well, who do you think was powerful enough to give permission for the body to be stolen? The same man who owned the tomb. See, so this is the last, one of the last moments Joseph Arimathea has as a Jew. He's going to have to become a Christian. Okay, so in an interesting way, even though some people, you know, look at Nicodemus, look at Joseph of Arimathea as people who never stood up for Jesus, you know, in front of the Sanhedrin, yet when no one was there for Jesus, he was the only one present. You know, so there's something to be said for that. You know, and also the fact that, interestingly, none of these people had been assured of the promise of the resurrection yet. They hadn't seen it happen. And yet they're willing to risk their whole lives to do a kindness to Jesus with no necessary sense of return. You see what I'm saying? So Jesus hasn't risen from the dead, so they can't say, well, Jesus rose from the dead, I'm leaving Judaism now. Joseph of Arimathea hasn't seen Jesus resurrected from the dead. He just died. And yet he's willing to put himself out there. Maybe he had a sense that, you know, Jesus was, he would come back. He would be resurrected. Who knows? Okay. But it's very interesting, you know, as we study this closely, you're looking at these different characters of the Passion, kind of wondering what is going through their minds. Like, of all times now, Joseph, you step forward? I mean, wouldn't it be more expedient for him to just kind of withdraw, maybe hold a private opinion about Jesus? But he was the only person who was a friend of Jesus who had enough clout to go to Pilate. The apostles couldn't because they were nobodies. And they certainly would be marked men themselves because they were associates of Jesus. So the only person who could get the tomb from Jesus was a guy on the inside, someone in the Sanhedrin, powerful enough to get a hearing with Pilate. I mean, it's not like anyone just walked to Pontius Pilate's front door and said, can I talk to the governor? You know, we can't do that today in a democratic society. You know, you just knock on the gate of the White House and say, is the president available for a few minutes? You know, that ain't happening, okay? So, you know, it's very interesting, this Joseph of Arimathea. I mean, I think there's a lot to meditate on about his faith and his timing. It's very unusual that he would come forward now when, in a certain sense, there's nothing to be gained by this good work, at least from his perspective as a Jew. Okay? Okay, so let's move on. Oh, we're so close. It's like finishing a marathon. I'm going to cry. Okay, so next day, that is after the day of the preparation, the chief priests and the Pharisees gathered before Pilate and said, sir, we remember how that impostor said while he was still alive. Okay, this is what I'm talking about, right? After 3 days, it will rise again. Therefore, order the tomb to be made secure until the third day, lest his disciples go and seal him away and tell the people he has risen from the dead, and the last fraud will be worse than the first. Pilate said to them, you have a guard of soldiers. Go make it as secure as you can. Ha, ha, ha. Good luck, guys. Okay? It's about to happen. No force of nature is ever going to be able to turn back. So they went and made the tomb secure by sealing the stone and setting a guard. Okay. Now, just about that for a sec. I'll make sure that I don't leave anything in here. Okay. Now, this is very interesting. The Sabbath began on 6 p.m. on Friday. The last hours of Friday were called the preparation. If that timing is correct, the Pharisees actually approached Pilate on the Sabbath, which they were not allowed to do. because it broke Sabbath law. They came out of their house and they talked to a Gentile. Two big no-nos. And this is accurate. There are hardly any other incident in the gospel more plainly shows how desperately eager the Jews were to totally eliminate Jesus. Not only in life, but in death. It wasn't enough that he was dead already. They needed to make sure that there was no possibility that he could have risen from the dead, as they claim. Okay? It's interesting. There's a grim irony here. These Jews came to Pilate saying that Jesus had said that he would rise after 3 days. They did not admit that they envisaged the possibility that they might be true. But they thought the disciples might seek to steal away the body and say that a resurrection had happened. Okay? So it's kind of ironic, you know. It's like they're anticipating what is already actually going to happen. And they think that their human devices of sealing the tomb and setting the guard is going to be enough. They have no idea the power of the resurrection and what that's going to mean. It's just like, it's a very, you know, it's like putting a Band-Aid on a huge gash. Like, yeah, that's going to really help, you know. Okay, here we go. Now, chapter 28. Oh, moment of silence. Now, after the Sabbath, toward the dawn of the first day of the week, so this is Sunday morning after the Sabbath, okay? Mary Magdalene and the other Mary went to see the tomb, and behold, there was a great earthquake, for an angel of the Lord descended from heaven and came and rolled back the stone and sat upon it, okay? His appearance was like lightning, and his clothing white as snow. And for fear of him, the guards trembled and became like dead men. But the angel said to the women, "Do not be afraid, for I know that you seek Jesus who was crucified. He is not here, for he has risen, as he said. Come, see the place where he lay. Then go quickly and tell his disciples that he has risen from the dead, and behold, he is going before you to Galilee." That's 2 hours north. Okay? So where's Jesus returning? To where it all began. Nazareth. Okay, where he started his ministry. "Behold, I have told you." So they departed quickly from the tomb in fear and great joy. Interesting, they have both of those emotions. Scared out of their wits that it is an angel, yet joyful at the news of what he said. Okay? "And ran to tell his disciples, and behold, Jesus met them and said, 'Hail!' And they came up and took hold of his feet and worshipped him. Then Jesus said to them, 'Do not be afraid. Go and tell my brethren to go to Galilee, and there they will see me.'" Okay? Now, one of the things that's worth noting here is Jesus first appears to the women before he appears to the men, in part to reward their loyalty at the cross. But you know what the other tradition is, even before this all happened? Who Jesus appeared to? Mary. You guys aware of that ancient tradition? That before Jesus appeared to Mary Magdalene and the women, and before he appeared to the apostles, he already appeared to Mary. Do you notice she's conspicuously absent from all of these different... The tradition is that Mary didn't have to go to the tomb. Jesus already appeared to her and said, "I'm back, Mom." Now, it makes sense because, you know, we call her co-redemptrix, not co-pilot or co-redeemer, but co-redemptrix, which means chief cooperator with the work of redemption. I mean, considering yesterday's feast, the Immaculate Conception, I mean, if you're the Immaculate Conception and you're the mother of the angels and saints and the Queen of Heaven and Earth, it would make sense that before you make a proclamation to the rest of the gang, you might want to check in with the Queen Mother. Right? If you're the king, right? So, you know, it's like you think of any political person today. You know, before he makes a major announcement, he's going to gather his family together. And even before maybe the family, this is his wife or his queen. Now, in this case, remember, the king and the queen in the Jewish system was not husband and wife. The Jewish system was son and mother. That's king and queen. Remember, Solomon is the king, Bathsheba is the queen, even though she's his mother. So that same dynamic applies. So it would make sense. I mean, you know, if you're going to make a major announcement about something that's happened to you, you're going to gather your most intimate, you know, family members. I mean, maybe, you know, certainly your wife, if you know you're a man, and your children, and say, "I'm going to announce tomorrow this, but I want you to know now that you don't hear it from the news, you hear it from me." Okay, and you know, they have a day to sleep on it before you know, the media frenzy begins, you know. I think of Herman Cain. Okay, so, Gloria, there are about 10 more women who are going to come forward. But if I would drop out now, we probably won't know about them. Okay, suddenly, you notice how he's not in the spotlight? No more revelations. Everyone wants a book deal. Okay, so there they go. Okay, so now he's leaving. Now, it's interesting, right, because it's like our Lord's like, I'm tired of Jerusalem. Let's get out of here. Okay, I'm going 2 hours north of Galilee. If you've ever been to the Holy Land, Galilee and Judea are very different. Judea is very dry with a desert and has Jerusalem as a centerpiece. Place of confrontation. It's noisy. It's loud. It's a city. It's dirty. Nazareth in Galilee, Cana, Tiberias, the Sea of Galilee, very idyllic, very calm. I mean, it's like being on retreat up there in the countryside. You notice that it's no wonder Jesus likes to be up there and not down in the city. He liked the countryside, you know. And all of his first associates were country bumpkins. You know, they weren't sophisticated Pharisees from the city like the elite. They were simple, plain men from the countryside. Okay. All right, report of the guard. Now, this is where things get really good. Okay. So while they were going, behold, some of the guard went into the city and told the chief priests. Here's a great payoff. When they had assembled the elders and taken counsel, they gave a sum of money to the soldiers and said, tell people, his disciples came by night and stole him away while we were asleep. And if this comes to the governor's ears, it will satisfy him and keep you out of trouble. So they took the money and did as they were directed. And this story has been spread among the Jews to this day. It's true. I have a friend who's Jewish. And I said, what do you think of Jesus? Some guy. Prophet? Nope. Spiritual man? Maybe. But at the end of the day, some guy. I mean, among many of the Jews, there's a great disdain for Jesus. I mean, it's not just an indifference, but a disdain. Okay? Because, and, you know, this, of course, doesn't help. Because Matthew's calling them out. Now, this is very interesting, too. Matthew is the human author, right? God is the author of all Scripture, but he has human instruments. Matthew's a Jew. And this is an indictment on his own people. You know, because Matthew is an eyewitness to the resurrection. He will be in the upper room on that night when Jesus walks through the locked doors. He'll be there. Okay, so he is upbraiding his own people for their hardness of heart and saying the only way you can account for what we have seen, what we witnessed with our own eyes, is a payoff. That's the only thing you can say. Because there's no other explanation for what we saw. It's beyond all comprehension. Interesting, isn't it? Okay. And now the final four verses. Oh, so sad to be done. So now the 11 disciples went to Galilee, to the mountain to which Jesus had directed them. And when they saw him, they worshipped him, but some doubted. Now, isn't that interesting? Still. And it's interesting Matthew includes this. Now, I just want to make a point here. Matthew includes Judas. He includes Peter's denials. All of these inclusions of these stories are part of what helps to authenticate the scriptures as true. Because if the scriptures are being used as a tool for building up the church, normally speaking, you don't accentuate or even mention the foibles of the early founders, right? You'd like to gloss over them, right? Like, you know, for example, if you're selling a condominium, you don't have a list in the back of all of the problems. The homeowners association is crazy. There are too many pets. Traffic around here is not. I mean, you don't put any of that stuff down, you know, and you even come up with creative ways of sort of glossing over some maybe obvious things. I mean, you might be right by the highway, but, you know, immediate access to 395. But don't mention the fact that it's noisy as all get out outside, okay? You see what I'm saying? Okay. So, or you might say you're in a crime infested neighborhood. Cultural opportunities abound, you know? I mean, you see what I'm saying? So the part of the authenticity of the scriptures is the fact that you put in there things that are not very flattering, including this. Post-resurrection, some of them still doubted. So Jesus knows this. So how many more days does he have with him? 40 more days. It wasn't enough. 40 more days. Don't worry, I'm with you guys. 40 more days. I just want to make sure before I go, okay? 40 more days. So, you know, I mean, it would make sense. You know, Jesus' time had been finished here. He had done what he said he would do, came to accomplish what he mainly came to do. Yet he sticks around for 40 more days to just make sure that the guy's got the story. Okay? Yeah. All right. So, some doubted. And when Jesus came to them, all authority and said to them, "All authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. Go therefore and make disciples of all the nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit, teaching them to observe all that I have commanded you. And behold, I am with you always to the close of the age." Amen. Now, interestingly, what event is not in here? The ascension. It's not here. It's almost as if Matthew leaves it open-ended because there are 40 more days to follow. And he was with the Lord. Remember, Matthew and John were eyewitnesses. Mark and Luke were not. Okay? Mark is St. Peter's secretary. Luke is taking most of his information from Mary. Okay? He's a Gentile convert to Christianity. So it's like Matthew almost leaves it open because it's like he's almost not ready to write the ascension part. Not that he didn't see it, not that it didn't happen, but it's just like, you know, there was more for us to happen. We were going to do more with him. You know, it's very interesting how he leaves it like that. It's not very neat in a certain sense, okay? Jesus gives the apostles three imperatives: to believe, to share what they have seen, and to rejoice that they have seen it. Okay? Jesus assures them of his power. He grants them a commission to make disciples. And he assures them of his enduring presence until the end of the age. Of course, we believe that to be in the Eucharist. Right? Know that I am with you always until the end of the age. Got it. As he is. Questions? What a relief.
Isn't there a...
no questions. Okay, now. Okay.
A saying this is sort of the same kind of thing where when you were talking about the doubting, for as great a area of doubt there has to be, that's how one, what the belief is in proportion.
I'm sorry, I do not speak English. What do you mean? What
are they doing? Supposed to be, I can't remember how it's put.
A thousand difficulties don't make a doubt?
No.
No, I didn't think so.
I don't remember. Just put that out there. What it is. But it's in direct proportion to the opposite. If there's that many doubts, it's got to be the truth.
Okay.
And I think that sounds, that I guess, I don't remember exactly how or where I heard that.
Okay. Well, if you find it, send it to me.
I will.
I'm not familiar with that phrase. Does anyone?
Something that, yeah, I can't remember.
Like sin abounds, grace abounds all the more?
I mean, that would be logically correct in terms of that's the right syllogism.
I'll find it.
All right.
Thank you all for playing the scripture series. I fear this could be my last time teaching.